And now we're going to move right into our next panel with Pamela Wallin and our ambassadors. So I'm just going to move off to one side here and let Pam and Ambassador Jacobson and Ambassador Doerr come up, and then I'll briefly introduce you, Pam. And so speaking of hockey, we should say that Ambassador Jacobson is from Chicago and represents the Blackhawks at this meeting. And that Ambassador Doerr is from Winnipeg, former Premier of Manitoba, and represents the Winnipeg Jets, or at least their hopes of being. And we should say that Pam Wallin is from Wadena, Saskatchewan, where they don't have NHL hockey, but where they do have the Rough Riders and the Rough Rider Nation. Pam is, as many of you know, is a former host of Canada AM. She used to get up at 4 in the morning to go to work, and she finally found a better job as Consul General of Canada, later after working for both CTV and CBC as a news anchor for many years. Represented us with distinction in New York as Canada's Consul General to New York at the time of 9/11, in fact, Pam, wasn't it? That was quite a time to be in New York, an amazing time to be in New York. Ambassador Doerr is the former Premier of Manitoba, who's been representing us in Washington for, I think, two years now, Gary. Is that right?
16 months.
Okay. And Ambassador Jacobson is an appointee of President Obama and his recent arrival in Ottawa. And Pam, we're going to have this conversation about managing the relationship.
We are.
Take it away.
Some very interesting things. Thank you very much, Ian, that we heard, of course, that Nick has highlighted, because it is a little bit like the teenage girl that has the crush on the football player. And if he walks by and smiles at her, she swoons and goes, "Oh, my God, he's paying attention. I'm so thankful." And then if he ignores her, she goes into a fit of depression and tells her girlfriend that she doesn't really care about him anyway. And this is a real problem with the Canada-U.S. relationship. And we pay an awful lot of attention, and we live and die for their notice. And it makes us, I think, a little vulnerable on some issues. And I do think, I want to say that I think that's getting a little better. We used to say when we were in New York, a lot of the Canadian material that would come out of the Department of Foreign Affairs about promoting Canada would be about our wilderness and our mountains and our Mounties and our maple syrup. And we weren't looking like the modern Canadian nation, and we always used to joke if we could just get the blackberry in the hand of the Mountie, it might help us sell our message a little bit better in the United States. Okay, I think Derek will probably know the source of this quote better than I do. I can't remember, but Canadians believe that Americans are our best friends whether we like it or not, and Canadians are Americans' best friends whether they care or not. So that's kind of the context. Do you know who said that? I can't.
The first part is Robert Thompson.
Something like that. All right. So I have two things I want to start with. This is something I read somewhere. On the sixth day, God turned to the Archangel Gabriel and said, "Today I'm going to create a land called Canada. It will be a land of outstanding natural beauty. It shall have tall, majestic mountains, beautiful, sparkling lakes, high cliffs overlooking sandy beaches. I shall call the inhabitants of this land Canadians, and they shall be known as the most friendly people on earth." "But Lord," asked Gabriel, "don't you think you're being just too generous to these Canadians?" "Not really," God replied. "Just wait and see the neighbors I'm going to give them." So we will start there, because this is the other thing I carry around with me. This is from the New Yorker. This is a man and a woman sitting in a smart New York bar having martinis. And the man says to the woman, "You seem familiar, yet somehow strange. Are you by any chance Canadian?" That's the stage I'd like to set, gentlemen, as we have this discussion. Two people who bring an awful lot of experience to this relationship, and I'm very glad to say, I've got to say, as someone who's now worked inside that, to see people who understand how politics and business is conducted, it's really important to have these kinds of players in these two respective roles, because we can't afford in our countries to have an ad hominem foreign policy that if we happen to like the president, relations are good, and if we don't like him, then relations are bad. It's just too big. You can't do $3 billion worth of business every day and run your operations that way. So let me start with Ambassador Jacobson. How would you describe at this moment the state of the relationship?
Well, it depends if I'm speaking as the football player or the bad neighbor. I think that today the relationship between the United States and Canada is probably the best that it has been in a long, long time and perhaps ever. And I think there are a host of reasons for that. I agree with you, it should not be focused and ideally not focused on personalities and on interests. And I think we've seen our interests come together in many ways all over the world. But it's also partly personalities. Obviously, the president and prime minister get along well. I think what's very important, quite frankly, is that the Canadian people and my president get along better than I think a lot of the American people and my president get along.
These days.
And I think that that's very important. But, I'd love to take the credit with Ambassador Dewar for this, but I think it belongs elsewhere. But I think the relationship is as good as it's been in a long, long time.
Ambassador Dewar?
Well, I think it's very positive. I always felt that as a premier working north and south, both in Washington and with other colleagues, governors that have now, a lot of whom are now in the Obama cabinet. So it's useful to know. Today's governor you're having a beer with is tomorrow's cabinet secretary. That's a useful investment of Canadian time on our relationship.
I'm not sure if that's a promotion or not.
Well, I won't comment on that. I can't possibly comment on that. I'm a diplomat. I did go 4 days to diplomatic boot camp, so I'm very well trained. I didn't take the 2-week course.
Yeah, I don't think
Senator Wallen. But I feel that Canadians are confident. I think the more confident we are, the more confident we can be with the United States. I don't feel like the girl chasing the football player. I got to admit that. Yeah. I feel very, very confident. I did before. I feel that way now. In terms of the ability or the concern that Canadians have that we're not leading the news in the United States, a friend of mine, a prominent broadcaster on CNN, says you don't want our cameras at your embassy in Washington. We are in front of the Haitian embassy, regrettably, with that tragedy last year. We were in front of the Mexican embassy with the shootings in Juarez. We're recently in front of the Egyptian embassy. So I don't worry about, I think sometimes we've got to explain to Canadians, you don't necessarily want CNN in front of your embassy in Washington. It usually is not for good news. I also think that the Olympics, where, you know, we talked about CTV with Nick Nanos, the coverage in the United States was extremely positive. And it wasn't just the athletic events, and it just wasn't the thrill of Americans winning a lot of medals for the American audience and Canadians winning, thankfully, the gold medal in men's and women's hockey for us at the Olympics. But it was also the vignettes. Tom Brokaw gave a piece about how great our relationship is, and there was lots of other coverage. So the most coverage we got in the last 18 months was the Olympics. I do also agree, though, that we have to continue to work on the relationship. Nick Nanos raised a question about 9/11, and as a premier who was called and was told we were potentially getting up to 70 planes landing in Winnipeg, and we ended up with 17, and somebody who worked to get the memorial at the Peace Gardens in North Dakota, Manitoba, we are working on a number of events with 9/11, and it is very important. We are going to work, have an exercise in Washington dealing with resiliency. We've suggested to our government that we include people from Gander in Washington. The president's going to be speaking at that event. We want our prime minister to be speaking at that event. We're also going to have events around the police and fire games. Canadian firefighters and police officers will be in New York for that 2-week period. We want to have events around that. And obviously the victims' families that will be in New York for that 10th anniversary and the other events that Mayor Bloomberg is going to host. Nick Nanos is absolutely correct. We are going to be involved and cooperate on the commemoration of those victims and the celebration of our democratic values with the United States.
It was a very powerful moment, and I
yes.
did have the, and I say this quite sincerely, I had the privilege of being in the United States at that time, because when people are suffering that kind of pain and trauma and shock, they are extremely vulnerable, and it allows, in an interesting way, an openness in the relationship. You can reach out. I actually made friendships and relationships at that time that I might not have been able to in another circumstance. And it's been a wonderful thing, and it's also not our finest hour in some ways. Nick was talking about the public running ahead of the politicians. That was true. While the folks in Gander were opening their arms and their homes and their doors, and I had for 4 years people coming to the concert to say thank you, we also had a political response that was that caused some waves. A lot of people think the tension was about our decision on Iraq. There was tension about our response to 9/11 at the time, that somehow that wasn't our issue, that the crisis was an American issue. Where do you think that is in the psyche of Americans right now, David?
Well, I think the Prime Minister, when he visited the President, or when he met with the President the first time, I think made the point very clear that the security of the United States is the security of Canada.
Right.
I think that there is, in American citizens' minds, a respect for Canadians. You aren't always at the top of our minds. You know, Libya is at the top of our minds at the moment. That's probably not where you want to be. But I think in terms of respect, not only just anecdotally myself, when I was appointed the ambassador, I got literally hundreds of letters and emails and calls, some from people I knew, some from people I didn't know. And there was one common thread throughout all of them, which was, God, you are the luckiest guy in the world. You're going to this great place and wonderful people and incredible, important relationships. So anecdotally, but recently, one of Nick's competitors did a poll of favorability ratings in the United States and Canada of other countries around the world. And Canada finished by a long shot first in the United States with the highest favorability rating. I think it was 94%, and there was probably like a 7 or 8% margin of error, so maybe it was 102 in actuality. But that Americans, not only do Canadians, I think, view the security of the United States as important to Canada for a whole variety of reasons, but Americans understand that. There's one other thing I just wanted to add to what you were talking about with respect to the September 11th anniversary. There is another anniversary that's coming up in 2012 that I also think is very important. And that is, and in all seriousness, the 200th anniversary of the War of 1812. And to me, it's very important because it gives hope to the rest of the world that 200 years ago, or now 199 years ago, people on both sides of these borders were fighting each other and killing each other. And today, I think, without question, Canada and the United States are the closest of friends of any two countries in the world. And for places in the world where they're not getting along so well and they are fighting and killing each other, I think it demonstrates that there is hope for the rest of the world. So I think we've got a couple of very important anniversaries coming up, and we ought to celebrate both of them.
Yeah. And I hope we don't, you know, we've actually had some discussions about that the marking of the War of 1812 doesn't become one of those things where Canadians want to resort to, you know, we won.
I think
it should
be just reversed.
I think we're going to find both countries are going to claim
victory. Right.
Exactly.
We all retroactive victory.
Right, yeah.
Claim victory and go home.
But I like the tone you're setting instead.
Claim victory and have a beer and celebrate our history together.
I was looking through just quite accidentally yesterday at Time magazine from 2005. I checked the date just because the Time reporter was describing the relationship at that point, that Canada was somewhere along in the same category as North Korea. at that moment for being not very popular. And we really do see these ebbs and flows in a dramatic way. The reaction after 9/11, where our Prime Minister did not go at that time, then the response when John Manley took up the border issue. And it seems to come and go with incidents already. We've gone from shared borders now to beyond borders. Gary, where do you see this going? Is there a pragmatism now in the politicians following that pragmatism we see in Canadians, which is let's get on and fix some of these things?
Well, I think in 2005, there it was shortly after, in historical terms, the decision Canada made on Iraq. Yeah. And one would argue that perhaps, I would argue that perhaps we made the right decision. Although emotionally it was very tough for Canadians, even if they agreed in the intelligence of that decision, emotionally it was very difficult, no matter what side you were on of the actual decision. It was very difficult emotionally to have the United States and the UK in that dangerous situation and not be there with them, which historically, in many situations, we had been in. And so there was an emotion, and there was also a cognitive decision by the government. It is ironic, of course, that that President Obama, as candidate Obama, basically took the same view that Canada took about that conflict, although he is now responsible for it and trying to wind it down appropriately as he had promised in the campaign. But yes, that was the UK was fighting along with the Americans in a very difficult situation, and we weren't. And that was obviously, I don't think, accurately reflected in Time magazine, but you can't sell any copies if you don't embellish the storyline. I think the relationship, I think Canadians are very confident. We're very confident about the future, and it allows us to make decisions based not necessarily on pundits' opinions and different political comments, but on the basis of the public, where the public are at. I also think it requires us, when we go back to 9/11 and we go back to how we can manage going forward on the border, it's important for the ambassador, for example, to completely communicate the message to the Prime Minister about we see a terrorist threat in the United States as a terrorist threat to Canada. But it's equally important to also explain to Canadians that it's not a human right to cross a border. Our nostalgic view of having the right to go and play baseball or hockey or shop in the States, that is not going to be there anymore. So we have to manage our information and technology in a way that provides for protection of citizens on either side of the border. And that's why I think the perimeter vision makes so much sense. Because when we talk about the Olympics, people in Canada and the United States don't realize that the perimeter vision for the air security for the whole Olympics was provided out of Colorado Springs in NORAD, and the protection on the sea in northern United States and southern Canada on the Pacific coast was again coordinated by NORAD that's been doing that job in an evolving way for 53 years. So that's a good model to use to manage our border, where we share information but we get it more efficient for the movement of goods and services. And I think it's underpinned by Canadian confidence, which I think is useful.
I agree. I mean, I noted one of Nick's points, that the distance from 9/11 means our intensity, our feelings about the need for joint security or that those issues are preeminent has waned, at the same time that we're much more accepting of the notion. The Americans proposed this at the time of 9/11, and Canada essentially, I'm condensing a bit of history, but said no, that would infringe on our sovereignty. Then we started talking about borders, but the Americans quite clearly said to us, if you don't want to worry about the perimeter, if you don't want to do that with us, then you understand the 49th is going to become a very thick line and continue to get thicker, which is now, 10 years later, what we finally figured out. We need to do something about this when we're so dependent on each other for trade and energy and the movement of people.
Well, you know, again, as a premier, I always supported the idea of using NORAD as the model. And I recall even 2 weeks after 9/11, the Council General was in the legislative buildings, and there was a threat of a Time Warner plane being hijacked and moving across and heading towards Manitoba. And quite, you know, we were scrambling jets from obviously from Canada, but also from Minot, to make sure we could protect ourselves. So that's, we've been doing that for a long time. So I always thought the idea of perimeter security is, makes sense, because we're doing it, as I say, in NORAD for a number of years. But that was a decision made. I think we did proceed with lots of work on border security. It's just the vision, I think, is, I think we're taking the next appropriate step. And I think we can manage a lot more of those issues inside of that vision that was announced by the Prime Minister and the President.
What still gets under our skin from time to time, David, and I know you'll know this because you're hearing it. I was just in Washington about 3 weeks ago. I chair the Defense and National Security Committee at the Senate. So we were down there for meetings, meeting with a series of people, including folks like John McCain, who I know better, who sat at a meeting and said the 9/11 terrorists came from Canada. Hillary Clinton, who is most days very rational, talks about the threat from the northern border, certainly when she was a senator from the state of New York. And we understand the imperative of politics, but boy, it's unhelpful when that stuff keeps coming up.
Well, I will agree it is unhelpful when people misstate facts. There's no question about that. I think one of the things that everybody has to keep in mind is that this beyond the border notion, this isn't a security deal. Okay, that there is a false choice that I think a lot of people had in mind, particularly soon after 9/11, that we had a choice. We had a choice between efficiency, moving people and goods efficiently across the border, or security. And I think we have come to the realization on both sides of the border that that is a false choice, that if we are smart, if we do this right, that we can have both, that we can be more secure than we are now on both sides of the border, and we can be more efficient. There is, if you talk to the experts, they always talk about the fact that we need to divide, whether it's people or goods, the things that move across the border, the people that move across the border, into three buckets. There is the bucket of what they technically refer to as the RBGs, the really bad guys. And that's a small bucket, and we more or less know who they are, and we can stop them. And then at the other extreme, there are the people who are good and who we know are good. And then there are the people in the middle. And the trick is to move as many of the people in the middle to the good category, a few of them maybe to the RBG category, but most of them to the good category, and to know before they get to the border that they're good. That way we spend less time checking my grandmother and more time looking at people who we're not so sure about. And I think the rest of us who have been pre-cleared in one way or another are able to move across the border more efficiently. I think it's an example, and it applies to goods, it applies to everything. It is how we can be both more efficient on the one hand and more secure, and I think we've come to that realization.
If
I might, and I agree with everything the ambassador has stated, but when we're dealing now in Washington with border issues and security issues and threats to either one of our populations, we are dealing with the traditional issues that the ambassador has laid out. But we're also dealing, and I think the last 47 attempts on American lives or property were radicalized domestic populations in the United States. And secondly, the other big area that we're working on, not just with the United States and Canada, but with the UK, New Zealand, and Australia, the Five Eyes, as they call it, is the whole area of cybersecurity, both on the defensive side and on the I don't know anything about it, but on the offensive side. I know nothing about that. But the I know nothing. I'll be careful. I won't say anything more than that. But on cybersecurity, it's, you know, we're finally getting the capacity to deal with defense institutions and defense systems, but we're also working together on government and critical infrastructure. And this is huge in terms of the challenge between our two countries. It doesn't lead the news very often, except when something is obviously compromised. But it's an area that we are spending a lot of time together on. Some of the first identification of compromise came about by Canadian investigations. But it is something we are there's 50,000 people, I think, working on it in Washington alone. And we obviously are working with them on it.
This is going to be an issue that we all hear more and more about as we go forward. And it isn't just national security systems and defense systems. It's our banking system. It's electric utilities. It's telephones and cell phones and everything else, the things that our societies depend on.
Yeah, I mean, I think in fairness, when we began, one of your predecessors, Paul Cellucci, talked, you know, and tried to use the shorthand to explain to Canadians security trumps trade. And I think some people understood what he meant, that, you know, you can't get the goods across the border until it's a secure border. But we were having two conversations as countries like this, where you were talking about security and we were talking about trade and business, and it actually was the same conversation.
Right.
It just got... on that issue, and Nick and Ian touched on this as well, is the whole question of energy, and it's particularly key right now as we watch Libya and what's going on across the Arab world, as we see what's happening in Japan, which has changed the discussion about nuclear as an issue. Certainly in my time there, and I'm sure every ambassador, past and present, understands that people do not... Americans don't get that we're your largest energy supplier. And in fairness, I'm not sure Canadians get that we're your largest energy supplier. Now I think that's going to become a much more real issue. And I found the discussion in the U.S. a little more open this last visit, because you can't really look at the situation that's going on and talk about Canadian oil is dirty, exclusive from... you know, where other sources of energy come from and what goes on in those countries. Do you sense that debate is now moved past?
Without getting into the nuance of some of the environmental consequences, which we can talk about separately, I think it is true that as a general matter, and again, anecdotally, when I tell Americans, hey, Canada's our largest foreign supplier of oil, they're going, you're kidding me, it's Saudi Arabia. Right. Actually, Saudi Arabia's fourth.
Yeah.
And Americans generally don't understand that. That's one side of this. The other side of it, however, is that if you ask Americans what is the safest and most secure foreign source of oil, that's easy. It's Canadian oil. So the Americans, whether it is elected officials, whether it is just ordinary folks on the street, understand the importance of the relationship, understand the importance of the friendship. I think ordinary citizens are probably less aware of the critical role that Canada plays in supplying us with foreign oil.
The poll was taken in August, so it would be interesting to see whether there's any changes after what happened in the recent events in the Middle East and the unfolding events in the Middle East. I think that we can't rely on only energy security as a country and assume that everything we've done to improve the environment is understood or will be communicated in what I would call to be a factual way in Washington, particularly Washington, where there is a debate of advocates that go on, and I call it the frozen facts. So we've got it at the front end, say the Keystone Project or any other potential project in the future, identify the improvements we've made on the environmental side, as well as pointing out that candidate Obama, now President Obama, campaigned on weaning the United States off of Middle Eastern and Venezuelan oil in 10 years as a candidate. And, of course, we agree with that position, obviously, from a very self-serving way. Everything we do, whether it's the border or energy or trade tied to the border, we also have to communicate more effectively on jobs. The United States has a very high unemployment rate, stated and unstated. And this is a time in our partnership where Canada has a much lower unemployment rate, and it's acceptably high in both countries. But we should understand that when we're talking about improving border, the Detroit River crossing that we're proposing will create tens of thousands of jobs. When we met recently with the president in the White House, we pointed out 901 companies in the United States, including 68 in Illinois, provide services and have jobs in Illinois supplying the oil sands.
I've got to interrupt here. This was a great moment, and I'm sure that it was very carefully scripted. But when we were in the Oval Office, and the President, the Prime Minister are talking, and they're talking about this issue, and the Prime Minister starts quizzing Ambassador Dewar, how many jobs in Illinois? He had the number. How many jobs in New York?
He just knew that.
He's looking around the room at where everybody came from. So yes. How many jobs in here? How many jobs in... He just had them. It was good.
I pointed out they vote, they cheer for the Bears, they vote for the President, and they work for Canada. Shameless.
Here's the other dilemma on this, and we see this this issue come back and forth from time again, the Buy America only, or, you know, the kind of protectionist sentiment. I remember as Consul General after 9/11 going to meet with a governor to try to convince them that this was wrongheaded because, you know, there are so many jobs at stake, because so many local plants were operating. And he looked at me puzzled and said, but this Buy America only stuff, it's aimed at foreigners. And did not understand why I was concerned as a Canadian. So sometimes we overreact as well, thinking that because you do tend to see us in the embrace. On the other hand, you don't want to be seen as taking jobs or being responsible for too many.
I think that's, especially on the Hill, it is when the foreign... I'm going to forget the title, the Foreign Manufacturers Legal Accountability Act. When I met with the person who proposed the bill, she stated to me, and I pointed out the surplus of trade her district had with Canada, again, shamelessly, it doesn't apply to Canada. And I said, well, it's not written that way. It does apply to Canada. We have Supreme Court decisions on both sides of the border that implement any legal accountability under the trade laws. And we found that with Buy America, we didn't intend to Canada we would be impacted. We were after, and if you look at the ads in the midterm election, we were after China. We were after somebody else. So it is you're absolutely right. Having said that, if a law has a bad aim, it does affect us, and we have to deal with it. And we deal with it on Buy America. We didn't have open procurement for American companies into provinces. Similarly, the Recovery Act didn't allow for Canadian companies to bid outside of Buy America into 37 of the American states. What we had to do was offer reciprocity. And I remember meeting with Premier Charest and Prime Minister Harper in Quebec City when this first came out to try to get a proposal where we weren't asking for something we weren't willing to provide ourselves. So part of what we do is our own fault in the sense that it's, you know, that we're not... We're not complete angels on everything in Canada, even though we like to wear the white uniform, but we're not complete angels on everything.
We're always down there wagging our fingers.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well. The president believes very strongly that trade is good, that trade, not just between our two countries, but really between fair trade between any two countries is good. One of the major economic programs of this administration is the National Export Initiative, the notion that the United States will double its exports over a five-year period. And we are only going to be able to increase our exports if our markets are open to other countries, to other countries. And if we're going to be successful in that, the place we have to start is Canada. Just the statistics are overwhelming. Last year, the increase in trade increasing exports from the United States to Canada was $44 billion. Okay? That is roughly equivalent to the total exports that the United States sends to Germany. That's the increase versus the total. It is roughly equivalent to the total exports that the United States sends to the UK. It is many times larger than the total exports to several of these other countries that we're very concerned about. Going the other way, the increase in trade from Canada to the United States last year was $50 billion, which is three times the total exports from Canada to China. Yeah. I saw Nick's numbers about, China is a very important trading partner with Canada. You import a lot, but you don't export all that much. And that if we're going to be successful in the United States in creating jobs, This trade deal isn't because we're nice guys.
No.
We do this because it's good for us. We are nice guys, but football players. But we do it because it's good for us. It also happens to be good for you. So I think we have to keep that in mind. And, you know, whenever there are tough times in any country, protectionism rises. But we have to keep our eye on the ball.
40% of Canadian GDP. It's a big, it's a big number.
For the ambassador, and the ambassador and I work very closely together on a lot of issues, and it's really great to work with him because he's a can-do ambassador to get things done, and I really appreciate that. But it's also, when I go into an office in Washington, I don't go in as Oliver Twist, you know. We're their biggest customer.
Exactly.
You know, you're in business, you got to treat your biggest customer with respect. They're our biggest customer. So that's the approach you have to have, as the ambassador said. This is not love, trust, and pixie dust when you're coming into trade and dollars and cents and economic growth. You've got to speak on mutual self-interest. You can't speak in a way that's anything less than that in terms of dealing with American politicians.
And we're going to go to questions now, so I'll just give you a bit of a heads up that get ready for that if you're interested. But the jobs, too, are very different. They're the same, and you've got to work together. But one of the reasons Gary is so, that he handles Washington so well, he was so right for the job, is that as a premier, he had known governors. Very little of our activity goes on in the White House in terms of doing business, where you have to deal with the prime minister in our country because of the way our system is set up. Very different approaches on one level.
I think that there is much truth to that. And one other thing, going back to the point Gary made, while there are probably far more important reasons why the relationship is as strong as it is, I would like to think that the relationship that Ambassador Duer and I have at least contributes to that. We talk all the time, sometimes about important bilateral issues, sometimes about football, sometimes just, hey, what's going on? And I think that those personal relationships, while they are not going to allow us to come to some conclusion that's not otherwise in the interest of our two countries, it allows us to find that common ground much more easily, and he has been just an incredible partner.
Let's hear from one of your predecessors, Ambassador Jacobson, Gordon Giffin.
A country lawyer from Atlanta, Georgia, formerly a resident of Canada briefly. I think it's first a comment and then a question. The context of how we work together sometimes gets lost, and it evolves over time. To Ambassador Duer's point, I think Canada is at a point in your history where there's a confidence and a strong self-image that permits dealing with the United States in a different way than perhaps sometimes in the past. When I was involved in the Canada-U.S. dynamic, the government of the day was very concerned about trying to have legislation that would permit what's now taken for granted in Canada, and that's American preclearance in Canadian airports. We actually had to get a law passed in Canada that permitted American officers to enforce, in some limited measure, U.S. law on Canadian soil. The government of the day was very concerned that Canadians would not like that. Well, now when Canadians go to airports, they expect preclearance, and they're not too concerned about the technicalities. I suspect as you work on evolving the border, some of that evolution will help those efforts. My question is, in conferences like this, when we talk about Canada-U.S., it tends to focus entirely on North America and the 49th parallel and how much we sell to each other and so forth. I believe that the reason that the relationship is remarkable, not just good, but remarkable, is because of the way we have shared our values together around the world. And in my experience, the added component to the relationship between Jean Chrétien and Bill Clinton was that they would actually conspire to drive positive events around the world because of our shared values. Talk, if you will, a little bit about how Canada and the United States work beyond North America and how that shared experience actually is at least one of the legs on the stool of making this a remarkable
relationship.
We've
got Afghanistan, Libya, and
I think, Gordon, your point is a very good one, that Canada and the United States are partners in the world. In one of Nick's slides, the word cloud, one of the words I think was partners. And that is the way that the relationship is described to me in Washington when we go there. That Canada is our partner. They are our partner in Afghanistan. They are our partner today in Libya. They are our partner in this hemisphere in a variety of places. They were our partner in Haiti after the earthquake and since. Part of it is that there are, while we do not share every value, that I think it's fair to say that we share an awful lot of values. And we share those values and hope that those shared values become values elsewhere in the world. And there is no country, I think, that we rely on more in projecting those shared values than we do Canada. And I think that particularly what Canada has done in Afghanistan has earned you a lot of credit in Washington.
I was just in the West Wing with one of our senior people on a night and a half ago. And
he's such a name dropper.
I didn't mention any names.
I was just in the West Wing.
I was in the West Wing. Well, I didn't say White House. I didn't know what sounds more important. I don't know. Again, they didn't tell me that in diplomatic school, so I apologize. I was in the West Wing.
They didn't say anything there.
But they actually have people that work there that have an influence on Canada. And the ambassador's absolutely right. Libya, Egypt, Tunisia, what was going on in Yemen, the issues of information and humanitarian concerns about Japan. I mean, our original purpose of the meeting was the economic regulation harmonization and the whole issue of working on what's the next step on the border perimeter vision. It was all on all the international relationship we have. And when I first got to Washington, the people in that same building, said to me, we like your guy because he's straight up going into a G8 meeting or a G20 meeting. We know what we're going to get. He's got a good read on some of the other leaders and how the agendas are going to go. And that is not only the relationship is important, but the values are extremely important.
Well, and I think it's our understanding that when President Obama came to office, he did rely on Harper for a lay of the land because they're of not necessarily the same political stripe, but they're of a generation, which actually allows them to see the world. Let's go to Adam and see if there are questions not about the election for our two ambassadors.
We do have great questions. We have a question from Emily in Toronto for the ambassadors, and the question is, do you think that in recent years we've experienced a convergence or a divergence in Canadians' and Americans' preferences concerning policy issues, for example, border security or the environment, and how do you expect any such shifts to influence the extent to which the two countries cooperate on these issues?
Okay. Responses? Go ahead.
Well, a lot of the values of the Canadian public and the American public talk about the border, we talked a lot about that already, but in the environment, are very similar on values. We don't want to be actually impractical about it, but here we are in Montreal. We talked about the acid rain agreement yesterday. Canada, United States led the Montreal Protocol, which was an agreement started off with two countries, then into 16 countries, and now 165 countries to eliminate ozone-depleting material in the world. And this is this agreement has actually resulted in a reduction in GHGs more than the Kyoto Protocol because 165 countries are in it.
Exactly.
And ahead of time and ahead of schedule. Similarly with the acid rain agreement, the health results have been more positive than the projections, and the cost projections have proven to be incorrect. So we've had a lot of good examples just recently on vehicle emissions. Good for the economy by having reduced vehicle emissions in the new cars coming out of Detroit and Windsor, and good for cleaner air in terms of our two countries. So I think on values, Heather and I were in Copenhagen advising Minister Prentice on moving towards the Copenhagen Agreement. We've now signed on to the 17% reduction, as President Obama has committed to, by 2020 over 2005. Now, some things like coal plants will be going further ahead. Other areas, the Americans will go further ahead. It won't be exactly the same size fits all. But on values, our populations want cleaner air and cleaner water, and they want to do it in a way that maintains jobs and economic opportunity.
On this very question, David, one of the things, and I've said this publicly before, but when I was over in Afghanistan, Stanley McChrystal, who was then in charge of the operation, met with us, and he said, if I had my way, and this is as he was waiting for the troops, for the surge to arrive, if he said, I had my way, I'd put all the American troops that are arriving under Canadian command, because you guys get this. You get what counterinsurgency is, how to be war fighters and humanitarians. That's a place where I don't think people would understand how much our values have converged.
Well, you know, you talk about Afghanistan. I too was there and met with all the same folks and saw both how, particularly in the South, American troops were under the command of Canadian forces, and saw how they stood shoulder to shoulder and how we shared values and shared methods. And I was told repeatedly by American troops that how much they appreciated serving shoulder to shoulder with Canadians.
This question here.
Hi, my name is Kyle Rorick. I'm an MA candidate in history at the University of Ottawa. I'm currently completing a thesis on critical discourse analysis of anti-American discourse, especially in context of the Free Trade Agreement in the 1980s. So yesterday was quite intriguing for me to hear from former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney. As Senator Wallen mentioned earlier, and echoing Prime Minister Mulroney yesterday, unhelpful accusations, sand in the eyes, kicking the shins, they're all detrimental to the relationship. And I'm wondering, do you think that Canadians' passive and or at times aggressive use of anti-American discourse will ever dissipate? Or why do you think it has such a staying power in Canadian political culture?
Well,
it works in elections, but we won't go there.
That would be my point, that Canada, like the United States, is a diverse country. And when you have a diverse country, you are always going to have people who have opinions that I don't. I mean, people say things in my country all the time that I don't agree with. And I think it is probably inevitable when you have a country as large as the United States as your next-door neighbor that people are going to have strongly held views, and that there, I would like to think that some of those views are outliers. I've said that on repeated occasions. But you're probably always going to have it, and I don't take it personally. I don't think my country should take it personally. Conversely, when you hear something that at least you perceive as an outlier comment from the United States, you should take it in context as well.
I've met with a number of people that are doing PhD studies on Canada-U.S. relations in the U.S., and I'm surprised by how many of them have concluded that the reason Canada didn't go into Iraq with the United States was because of the anti-American feelings in Canada. And you say, well, what about the fact that Tony Blair was also going in there? And they go, oh. And I guess that wasn't part of their PhD study in terms of tracking Canada-U.S. relations. So, you know, sometimes you get these labels based on something completely wrong, because obviously the fact that the U.K. was also going in and Tony Blair was also supported the effort, it meant that the decision was based by the Prime Minister on what he perceived to be Canada's best interest in terms of that decision. It's sometimes I hear the portrayal of anti-American behavior in Canada based on what I think to be absolutely false assumptions on some of the major issues.
It's true as an undercurrent, but I think we are all, and Gordon and others have talked about this rise of a sense of confidence, and I think we're all closer to the position that not being Americans is not a definition of what a Canadian is, and we need to really move past that. Back to Adam, who has some questions.
We have a question from Anna from Carleton University, and she would like to know, To what extent, if any, have you found that Canadian-American relations have been shaped or influenced by both countries' diplomatic relationships with other countries?
Who wants to take that one? We can see Middle East issues. We can see a whole lot of things.
It's my, you know, my enemy's enemy is my friend.
I think we talked about that earlier, the Iranian sanctions, the Canadian military doing the technical report to verify that the North Koreans had sunk the South Korean ship, work on the Middle East and the our principal position on any negotiations has to start with the existence and survival of Israel as a state as opposed to some other country's view on that. You go down the line, Libya, Egypt, Yemen, Syria, Chinese currency, and how we're going to manage that, Chinese involvement in the sanctions and how we're going to manage that with the debate on Chinese currency, which gets a little more complicated. So I think that in that respect, we're usually on the same team on these international issues. Yeah. And so are our diplomats.
Tim Reed, I'm a lawyer and former UN peacekeeper. Just not to rain on this love parade, but it does seem that, you know, often in Canada we're either for the Americans or we're sort of blindly against them, and if we're for, we sort of take a small, less than proportional percentage of whatever they're doing, Afghanistan being a case in point. It seems we often don't have a sort of consideration that maybe we have foreign policy concerns outside of whatever the Americans and maybe the Brits are doing, and that maybe there are things which the Americans and or Brits are doing which are harmful or could help us. The prime example of this is in Africa. And we're, given our own comparative advantage, we are a specialist in developing natural resources. However, the Brits and the Americans have led sort of this Western support to Paul Kagame and Yoweri Museveni, the presidents of Rwanda and Uganda, and talking about shared values. I mean, these guys have, their actions have resulted in the deaths of over 6 million people in Central Africa. Canada is the second biggest investor in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which has potential to rival Canada's in natural resources. So the continued funding and support of these regimes is seriously not only killing millions of Africans, but endangering Canadian investment in a major way. So, I mean, could you just comment on that and whether maybe we should take a complementary versus a subsidiary or anti-American role on these things?
Well, I mean, I think as both have said, I mean, we're looking for shared interests when we go into places. I don't think we're going to agree on every single thing every day. Do either one of you want to?
Well, Brian Mulroney, Prime Minister Mulroney, yeah. I like the fact the Americans still call their presidents presidents.
Yeah, I do.
And by the way, on values, one of the things I've always respected before I got to Washington, but now that I'm in Washington, the way the United States treats their former leaders. Gordon Giffen and I were at an event on Monday night. All the presidents spoke. All the presidents had been utilized by successive presidents to do good work in around the world. It's something, you know, is all you always can learn from other people.
We can take a page from that book.
That value of using the expertise and the gravitas of former leaders is something the United States does. I think there's something we can learn from. Not just let me put it that way. And on the issue of international issues, last night, former Prime Minister Mulroney talked about South Africa and Canada taking a different view and a different strategy than his friend Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. So I think where we see things differently, we're going to act differently. And where we see a principled position, and usually it's on the how-to. It's not usually on the what. It's usually on the how-to. But I think that's a classic example where Canada does obviously maintain its sovereignty and its sovereign independent judgment on matters that are important.
Yeah, Cuba is another one.
Yes.
These are two sovereign countries. And the fact that we share values and the fact that we oftentimes see things the same way in our own sovereign judgment doesn't mean that somehow or another we're not acting in our own interests and acting within our own sovereignty.
Question here.
Thank you for coming to McGill. My name is Philip Duguay, and I just finished my course of study of law here at McGill. And I'm a dual citizen of Canada and the United States. So,
right. One of my guys.
I'm very concerned about the erosion of our nation's justice systems in the face of an increasing state security apparatus. And I have a very simple question, and I would really like both ambassadors to comment on it if possible. Why is it that a Somali pirate can get a trial in a civilian court in the U.S., but Omar Khadr has had to languish in Guantanamo Bay for almost a decade? Thank you.
Well, that's probably a question better put to political leaders rather than diplomatic leaders.
But I was just wondering if you could give the viewpoint of your governments and perhaps walk me through some of the subtler nuances of negotiations.
I think just simply on the Khadr point, this is a very, very difficult issue. Okay? The president wanted to close Guantanamo within a year. He was unable to do that because other countries would not take these people, and the Congress refused to provide him with the money to move them into the continental United States. This is one, quite frankly, we are probably going to have to agree to disagree on. I understand your point of view. I understand the point of view of many Canadians on this. I also understand the point of view of our government that we have to somehow or another be able to deal with this. Can't just let people go. And leaving Khadr aside, there are another 100-some-odd others. It is an enormously difficult question. I think that the president's heart is in the right place on this one, but sometimes when it comes to execution in exquisitely difficult issues, it doesn't always work out as easily as you might like.
Thank you for that. One final quick point from our internet.
We have a question from Daniel from Toronto, a more specific question this time. What is the current state of U.S.-Canadian Arctic policy, and where do you see positions on that issue moving in the coming years?
Go ahead.
Well, we are...
It's going to be settled in courtrooms, I don't think. We have to worry about the military buildup in the north, but go ahead.
I expect that our ministers of foreign affairs will be in Greenland at the Arctic Council meeting. There was a preliminary meeting in Copenhagen on a lot of the issues of sustainability and the environmental fragility of the Arctic. There's lots of very good discussions going on security. We have NORAD-led ships in the Arctic this last summer, the summer before that, and I expect this summer. We have a disagreement. There's four disagreements on water boundaries. One of them is in the Arctic. There's three others. But, you know, we have three oceans we share on the Beaufort Sea. And on some areas of the passageway, the United States has a very... Their position on waterways is not specific only to the Arctic, but you look at other places like the Straits of Hormuz, they have a broader issue of international security. We have a very strong view on our sovereignty of the Arctic, and we'll continue to cooperate in lots of areas, and we are, but it's I would say that there is some differences on us.
Just prove it. There are a couple of differences, yes. But I think in the Arctic, probably like many other things, the areas of cooperation and the areas of shared values so overwhelm the differences, and it is, yeah, it's easier, it's better news to focus on the places where we don't get along, but the fact of the matter is that we cooperate every single day in those places, and we're going to continue to cooperate, and I think it just overwhelms any difference.
We're very, very lucky to have these two men representing our countries. Thank you for sharing your thoughts.
Good job. Good job, man.
Thank you.
I say one more. If you gentlemen just want to remain on stage for a moment. Just apropos of that last point, there was a meeting between President Reagan and Prime Minister Mulroney in the PM's third floor center block office in April of 1987. And Mr. Mulroney had this antique globe that Paul Desmarais had given him and was pointing out the Northwest Passage and claiming it as Canadian waters. And President Reagan said, "That's not the map of the Arctic they showed me on Air Force One." So we want to thank, first of all, Pam, who's lost none of her skills over all the years, for doing a fantastic job of moderating this session. and our two ambassadors, there is a difference between taking a brief and knowing a brief and presenting it, and these guys are outstanding. We're so fortunate to have both of them representing our countries. And for diplomatic reasons, Ambassador Jacobson, we're not going to give you the McGill Olympic gold medal tie for reasons that we're sure, although we will remind you that the Blackhawks are the reigning Stanley Cup champions. And Zach Pakin, one of our McGill students, is going to make a presentation to both the ambassadors. Zach, are you here? There you go.
Bonjour à tous et à toutes, je m'appelle Zach Pekin. Juste avant de tout commencer, je voudrais remercier ma professeure, Madame Ioni, de tout avoir organisé pour toutes ces années de service ici à l'Université de McGill. Senator and both ambassadors, both of our nations are extremely fortunate to have both of you working in the incredible role that you're doing, and I can only hope that our great friendship, which is the greatest in the world, can only become greater over the course of time. May God bless our two great nations. Thank you.
So just to do a little bit of housekeeping here, we're going to take about a 14-minute break, but we have Minister Flaherty with us by video conference from Ottawa, and we're going to start that at 11 o'clock sharp because he's got a schedule today, so we have to try and, yeah, like the government's going to fall at 1:30. So, and Pam's got to get home for that, among other things. So when we come back after lunch, we're going to have a couple of great breakout panels on trade and later on the environment, followed and energy, followed by Premier Charest and Governor of Vermont. We'll see you back here in 13 minutes.